From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the eve of Michigan's primary, we're checking out some key races and outside factors affecting the politics.
Make no mistake, the looming reapportionment is playing a big role in how these races ultimately could turn out, because the Republicans, I think, struggled to get the kind of candidates they would have liked to have gotten.
Also, Michigan's newest Teacher of the Year talks about adjusting to online instruction.
In class, if a student has a question, I can answer it right away, and it also answers it out loud for the other 10 kids who are all thinking the same question in their heads. But in this virtual setting, I had to field 12 emails or texts with the same question.
Plus, an appreciation of a creative medium you may not have seen in museums or galleries, the art book.
It either fits into your expectations of a book, it turns, it has pages, or it blows your mind. You're not sure if you're even looking at a book.
Those stories and more, just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, Michigan's Teacher of the Year addresses anti-racism, LGBTQ identity, and equity in the classroom. That's coming up later on, but first, might seem difficult to get your head around with everything else that's going on, but elections are happening. Tomorrow's primary day in Michigan. Mail-in ballots are being received at city, township, and county clerks all over, and plans are underway for some in-person voting as well. With all 14 of Michigan's U.S. House seats up in the air, one Senate seat, 110 state House seats at stake, on top of all community-level candidates and issues, there's plenty to keep in mind. We're here with Gongmore News Service publisher Zach Gorchow and MLive reporter Emily Lawler to go over some of the top issues and voting etiquette during the pandemic. Zach, Emily, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for
having me. Good to be here.
So what issues do you think will be among voters' top priorities from the folks you've been talking with in your reporting? Emily, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the top races are garnering the most interest right now, with the exception, of course, of the presidential race, since we did that primary in March. But there's a lot of speculation right now around the U.S. Senate race. I know that John James has risen to really quite a prominent, almost a celebrity status within the Republican Party, and seeing how that translates into the ballot box. And then, of course, we've got our congressional districts, which have become more interesting in recent years, especially districts like the 8th and the 11th that are sort of newly Democratic districts that Republicans are looking at as in play this cycle.
Zach, does that dovetail with what you're hearing and seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a quieter primary than usual. Not surprising, because there's no statewide competitive primary that's up on the ballot. Also, you have this bizarre situation because of the pandemic where you don't have candidates really going door to door very much, not anywhere near the extent usual. But that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of really interesting races out there. I'd say probably there's a couple that really stand out to me right now. I think the biggest race on the ballot is the Oakland County executive primary between Dave Coulter, the current executive, and Andy Meisner, the county treasurer. The one that has the most heat with the most at stake, like by far. I don't even know if there's a close second. You know, I interviewed these candidates recently. And one candidate invoked the other's mother, and the other called the other a failure. So this is a race where there is no love lost, and there's a big stakes there.
That certainly sounds like a normal election year.
Yes. Yeah, that's really, other than, you know, everything else is so quiet, that's the one that's really generated some traditional animosity. I look at the races for Congress. I think, probably, the most important primary on the ballot is the one up in the Thumb and Macomb County to replace Paul Mitchell, who's not seeking re-election, because it is such a solidly Republican district that the winner of the primary is virtually assured to be elected in the fall. And you've got a lot going on there. You've got three interesting candidates, and that race has seen some traditional negative attacks. There's a lot of heat there. So I think that one is up for grabs, too.
See, Zach, that's interesting. When you started your sentence, I thought you were going to talk about the 3rd congressional district race, where Peter Meyer and State Representative Lynn Afendoulis are among those contending to try to replace Justin Amash.
Well, that's up there as well. But I think the difference there is there is some, I think the Democrats are going to make a real push for that district in the fall. So whoever wins the Republican primary, the two, three major contenders being Peter Meyer, Lynn Afendulis, and Tom Norton, they've got a fight on their hands for the fall. I mean, I think they're, whoever comes out of the Republican primary is the favorite, but the Democratic candidate, Hillary Scholten, is going to make a big push. You've got Kent County is changing considerably. That one's not over on Tuesday, whereas the one in Macomb and the Thumb, that one's over after Tuesday.
Sure.
Also, I would put on the radar the 13th with Rashida Tlaib and Brenda Jones. It doesn't look like a much of a match from a fundraising standpoint, but remember that Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones actually did have that seat for a short amount of time and in a primary that was split a lot of ways. Last time around, Rashida Tlaib came out on top. It split two ways this time around, and I think that makes it a little bit of a different contest.
We've actually got some more on that race to listen to in just a few minutes, so we will come back to the 13th. Emily, when we mentioned the 3rd, I was thinking about Grand Rapids and everything that's happened there over the past few months. How do you see the Black Lives Matter protests and related conversations impacting the election?
You know, I think they certainly will. And, you know, you mentioned things that have happened in that region recently. Obviously, they had a spate of protests that were, you know, more intense than what we saw in many other parts of the state. They also, for a time, were really spiking in COVID cases and having issues with local businesses who, in some cases, got sort of a double whammy with some of the protests spilling into their spaces and then also, you know, some COVID exposure at their spaces as well. So I think that that was going to be an interesting area to watch no matter what, because it's becoming less of a conservative stronghold and has traditionally been, you know, I would say the biggest population center conservative stronghold in Michigan. And I think it was going to be interesting either way, but recent events only make it more intriguing of a race.
We joke that things will never be the same after 2020, but I wonder if there may be a grain of truth to that in terms of elections. According to the Free Press, Michigan is expected to lose a seat in Congress once the census is completed this year. And as we all know, there's a state commission under construction to draw new district lines. Do you, either of you, see that affecting voters' decisions? I don't know if it's exactly top of mind with everything that's happening with the economy and COVID and protests, but do you think that some people in districts that may be changing are aware of that this year?
I don't think it's a factor in voters' decisions. This is about a candidate-to-candidate choice in the national political environment. However, redistricting played a big role in the candidate fields, and that is going to play a huge factor. You look at in the 8th district, this is Alyssa Slotkin's district, you know, the Republicans did not do well in the candidate recruitment department. I believe they have 4 candidates, none of which would be considered A-listers. And this was a race they really wanted an A-lister challenger. But the problem is the district is going to look so radically different after reapportionment next year that I think a lot of the top tier potential Republicans looked at it and said, well, why would I run for this now and have to go up against the Alyssa Slotkin buzzsaw when I can just wait? There could be a much more favorable district to go for, you know, in 2 years. And the same thing happened in the Haley Stevens district, I think, where again, Republicans have 5 candidates, none of which would be considered very strong. They certainly had a deep bench of potential strong candidates. But again, that district is likely to look radically different. So while I don't believe it's going to play any role in voters making their decisions, make no mistake, the looming reapportionment is playing a big role and how these races ultimately could turn out, because the Republicans, I think, struggled to get the kind of candidates they would have liked to have gotten.
Do either of you know much about how voter turnout looks so far? Obviously, this is the first time that voters have been able to get ballots, absentee ballots on demand en masse.
Yeah, I do think that absentees are up. I do feel like we say that a little bit every election, but you're right that that's expanded certainly with Proposal 3 of 2018. And we did see some increased absentee in the presidential primary as well. And then, you know, the pandemic also contributes to that. So I'm curious as to how many people actually show up at the polls in person. My strong suspicion is that many people who normally would go in person have chosen to do absentees this year, which of course could in fact affect processing time and delay our results a little bit here in Michigan.
We know that Governor Whitmer has not mandated that masks be worn at the polls due to, quoting here, legal concerns. But at the same time, she has said that they need to be worn in public spaces. Have either of you seen any guidance on what the difference is exactly?
I do think that she's said that the masks in polls are strongly encouraged, while citing the legal issues you mentioned. Of course, nobody wants to look like they're stopping someone from exercising, you know, their constitutional rights and their voting rights over a piece of fabric. So I think that might be a little bit of the perception issue. But I mean, yeah, you're right. Masks are required in public places. And I think that, you know, contrary to the guidance she's issued, for instance, to businesses, which is basically turn away anybody who doesn't have a mask or offer them an alternative like curbside. Poll workers are not getting that same instruction and aren't supposed to stop people from voting because of not having a mask.
Interesting. I suppose we should close with some information. If folks still haven't voted absentee or they still haven't registered, is there still time to do that? Zach, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, what you should do is take your ballot to your local clerk in person. There's usually a drop box. You know, I live in East Lansing. That's how I usually would go to the precincts to vote. But, I drove my ballot down to City Hall. There's a little drop box outside. I plopped it in there instead of putting it in the mail. And because absentee ballots received after 8 p.m. tomorrow will not count by law. And I think it's pretty safe to say if you tried putting it in the mail today, it's unlikely to arrive in time. So you're going to want to take it there in person. It's also possible to go to your clerk and just vote an absentee ballot right then and there, even if you don't have the ballot yet.
And we do allow same day registration now, too. So, if you aren't registered to vote, but still want to vote in this election, I believe you can go there on election day and get it all taken care of at once.
Emily Lawler is a reporter with MLive. We've also been speaking with Zach Gorchow, publisher of Gongwer News Service. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
One of the most heated primaries in Michigan is the 13th Congressional District. That's the seat that used to be held by John Conyers in Detroit. It's now occupied by Rashida Tlaib, and she's being challenged by Detroit City Council President Brent Jones, who briefly held the congressional seat. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter has more on the contest in the 13th.
In a modest Detroit neighborhood, Rashida Tlaib is campaigning door-to-door. She says greeting constituents in person during a pandemic can be a bit tricky.
And she goes, we gotta take a picture. So I said, nope, put your mask on though. And so she came down, we just did more of a selfie from her door. So that way it worked out fine.
The only Palestinian-American woman ever elected to Congress, Tlaib's become a political star. She found funding to improve drinking water and marched with those protesting police brutality. But Tlaib is best known as one of the four first-term ultra-progressive women of color in the U.S. House who call themselves the Squad.
It's not like we only look different. We also talk differently. We also serve differently and we feel differently. All I can do is represent my community. And they're asking me to speak loudly and very unapologetically.
Tlaib did just that when she famously and rather colorfully vowed to impeach President Trump before she was even sworn in. But her challenger in the upcoming Democratic primary says calling Trump names does not help fix Detroit's problems. City Council President Brenda Jones says she's running because voters want a different tone in Congress.
It will allow me to not embarrass the people in the 13th Congressional District.
The majority African-American district is one of the poorest in the nation, hit hard by job losses and the coronavirus. Jones announced in April she had tested positive for COVID-19 and is relying on direct mail and virtual campaigning, a tough task in a city where many cannot afford internet at home. But Joan says she's already spent years building a reputation for helping poor communities.
I'm interested in starting a squad myself, a squad of the people that have the poorest district in the United States of America. That would be my squad.
Joan's actually served in Congress for a month and a half, filling the seat vacated by John Conyers amid allegations of sexual harassment. She lost it to Tlaib by 1% in a crowded field vying for the full two-year term. Since then, Tlaib has raised both her national profile and millions of dollars of campaign cash. Some Jewish groups threatened to back whoever ran against Tlaib after she called for a boycott of Israel. Yet Jones has praised Louis Farrakhan, known for his anti-Semitic remarks. So the editor of the Detroit Jewish News, Andrew Lapin, says those donors are staying on the sidelines, despite their opinion of Tlaib.
An enemy of Israel, an enemy of the Jewish people, someone who should be stopped at all costs. But because Jones is perceived as being very close to Farrakhan, many Jews kind of see this race as being between a rock and a hard place.
But campaigning door-to-door, passing out sanitizer and tips on where to vote, Tlaib is a hit at every home she visits.
Okay. But you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I'm a political guy. I didn't grow up like that, but these times, they make you like that.
Thank you. Okay. Would you like a yard sign, sir?
In a nearby park, Detroiter Robert Patterson says he's lived in the district for half a century. He says in the current political climate, Detroit needs Tlaib and Jones.
Both of them are equally suited for their positions that they are now, and I don't see any reason to change.
In this heavily Democratic district, the verdict will come far sooner than November. Historically, whoever wins the Democratic primary wins the general election as well. I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
Artists have a lot of different ways to explore the ideas that they're working with. People can paint or draw or sculpt. You can make prints or lithographs, do murals or film something, maybe design the kind of happening that people can experience as a performance. But there are some artists who work in a format that borrows from literary forms, encouraging us to sit down with an object in our hands and contemplate. They're called art books, and it's a genre that you may not have seen very often in galleries, but for the people who make artist books and those who seek them out, they can bend the delivery of information in all kinds of interesting ways. Geo Rutherford got her BFA in Fine Arts at Eastern Michigan. She's a former resident of Ann Arbor who also taught in Chelsea schools. Right now, she's working on an MFA at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she has an art book project we wanted to ask her about. Geo Rutherford, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Do you remember the first time you saw an art book?
You know, I actually recently discovered them, but people for a long time had been telling me that I would be interested or good at making them. So I was aware they existed, but the first time I touched one was only about 2 years ago.
When we talk about artist books, we sometimes mean bound volumes that artists produce in small quantities. And sometimes we mean these accordion fold books that are a little bit simpler to put together because you don't really have to bind them. But what are some of the other shapes that an art book can take?
I mean, there are different traditional types of bookmaking, such as the accordion fold or the perfect binding or a Coptic stitch binding. There's all of those traditional books, but there's also a world of book arts where maybe a book is a mason jar or a book is a suitcase. And I'm really interested in that part of the world where artist books extend beyond our understanding of traditional approaches.
Can you just sort of walk us through, I suppose, how they work? If you were to sit down with an artist book, whether it be bound volume or mason jar or suitcase, what kinds of things do you find when you open them? How do they communicate?
Oh my gosh, I love that question. They communicate in so many different ways. What I love about artist books is that everyone has a relationship with books. So when you're presented with an artist book, it either fits into your expectations of a book. It turns, it has pages, it has a cover and a spine, or it blows your mind and you're not sure if you're even looking at a book. which is where my book falls. Most people, I think, wouldn't call it a book at first glance. It's only when I start to challenge their idea of book that they begin to accept my book as a book form.
So this project that you are working on now, the artist book that you have in development, is exploring the health of the Great Lakes. Could you describe the exterior of it for us?
So it actually looks like a box. When you encounter it, it's about 6 inches wide and 4 inches tall. And it has a nice deep lid. So when you pull the lid off, you encounter a box of vials or traditional vintage test tubes. And that's what you see when you look at the book, which is why I think it's hard for people to immediately translate it as a book.
What are the materials that you're using to give people the ethos of the lakes without actually sitting in them?
When you encounter the book, you're pulling out these tubes. The tubes, when you first look at the book, are a mystery. All you can see is the orange color of the top of the tubes in this blue box. On the lid, it says beach vines, so you're given a small hint, and the colophon says that I found the material at Bradford Beach in Milwaukee. So there's clues as you work your way into the book. But then, of course, as what is the most amazing thing about this book is it, working with it and touching it. I want everyone to be able to touch it. Artist books shouldn't be restricted like the way that a lot of art is when we put them in pristine galleries. So when you pull out one of these tubes, you turn the tube and you encounter material that I found at the lakes. This is natural material and unnatural material, such as crinoid fossils or sand, different kinds of insects that I've found. And it's also a lot of plastic or plastic-like material or odd and ends that I found around the lake. I even have a little spine in one of my books, and I have a dried-up round-eyed goby that fit into one of my tubes. So you find all sorts of different things while you're going through the book, and it starts to paint a picture of what the beaches actually contain beyond what you might expect.
Is there a controlling idea that even might occur to someone who takes in the book as they, even if they hadn't read a formal thesis statement that you'd written?
What I've been impressed with this book is that everyday people really get it. Where they look at the book and they understand that I'm showing them that there's pollution on the Great Lakes, that there's problems with the Great Lakes, and that the Great Lakes are not just something pretty to look at, but actually an amazing resource that we're taking advantage of.
We're talking with artist and educator Geo Rutherford. She got her BFA at Eastern Michigan and taught in Chelsea schools for many years. She's now living in Wisconsin and still working on art books. If you were to make a painting of the Great Lakes or do some collage work or even, I guess, assemble some sort of film project, you know, people might see it in a gallery and look at it and maybe even spend 2 or 3 minutes standing and sort of contemplating it. But it seems a little bit different than the time that they might spend with the art book that you made. What are some ways that you have tried to encourage people to spend more time with the work in the way you designed it?
This book in particular encourages people to spend time with it because there's something tactile about the experience that I don't find my other work always achieves, because I'm a printmaker and I make a lot of collages that I put on a wall, I put behind glass, you can't touch them. This book has kind of gone above and beyond my normal work because of that tactile element to them. There's a mystery that only going through the book can answer. And that's what encourages people to continue working with it and playing with it and touching it and engaging with it.
How have you been able to show this to people? Has the work been on view anywhere?
So I made a draft version of this book in about December. And it got into the juried student show at UWM Milwaukee. And it was on view in that show. And they were a little hesitant to let people touch it. But I was like, no, they have to touch it. And I just told them I would replace a tube if something happened. And so people got to touch it and engage with it. And it was the feedback I got was amazing, because that was the first time that everyday people encountered it, art people and other people. So it has been on display that one time, and it actually won second place, which was pretty cool because I don't feel like artist books always achieve that kind of status when they're being put next to photography or painting. Like, we don't always think of artist books alongside the rest of the art world.
Well, what were some of their reactions to it?
I feel like people were surprised, especially people in Milwaukee. They go to the beach all the time. The beach is right in their backyard. And same with people in Michigan. There's the Great Lakes are part of our identity. Because of that, I think that this book surprises people. They suddenly think, oh, wow, there's needles on the beach. There are pieces of Barbie plastic on the beach. How did this Lego end up on the beach? I think it starts to ask them questions about where this material has come from and where it goes and how they engage with it when they're on the beach. A lot of people that I've talked to about the book say that the beach feels different after they visited this book, and they are starting to see more than what they saw to start off with. An example of that is nurdles. Do you know what a nurdle is?
No.
Nurdles are the production plastic. They're these little tiny plastic balls, and they're all over the Great Lakes because a train car spilled in like the early 2000s and spilled all these tiny plastic beads all over the Great Lakes. I've gone to all of the Great Lakes, and they're on every single Great Lake, and they're right with the sand, and you can find them. And it's one of the things that I have in my book. And so people are like, what the heck is this? And then it makes them kind of engage with that material and start noticing it on the beaches, which is really interesting.
Okay, I just Googled nurdles, and now I want to go running back to the nearest beach and see how many I can find scattered amongst the stones, because I'm pretty sure I've walked over hundreds or maybe thousands of these in my life.
Definitely.
I have to ask, are art books really books?
I feel like they transcend the boundary between book and art. So yes, they are a book, but yes, they're also a work of art, which just makes them really unique.
They're sometimes bought by collectors, and they can appear, like yours did, in a sort of gallery show setting. But most often, artist books end up in special collections at libraries, like the University of Michigan has a pretty big collection of them. And I feel like a relatively small section of society ever gets to see them. Why do you feel like they're an important form?
So artist books are becoming more common, I feel like, or at least artists are becoming more aware of the form as something to create art with. That's what I've noticed, especially as teachers start to teach artist books and teachers start to bring like accordion fold or Coptic stitches into their classroom, you're starting to see it spread. But artist books are the result of the kind of ebb and flow of books in society. So even though books have been selling more, so if you look at like book sales, we're buying books more in society, but that's as a result of the fact that books are actually becoming less necessary. So anytime something is less necessary in society, we start to kind of aestheticize it. An example of that is the record player. It was the way that you listened to music for a long time, but then it kind of disappeared and was trumped by CD players or as we get into like Spotify and music streaming. As a result, we've seen the record player make a comeback. Now it's something that we want in society, something that people engage with and enjoy.
It's an object of hipster chic as well.
For sure. And we're seeing that with artist books. When we had the invention of the internet, we saw a rise in artist books because suddenly the book was less necessary. And so artist books are an aestheticized approach to book creation.
Is there something that artist books allow you to experience just yourself in the making of them that maybe other forms wouldn't let you do?
I love making artist books. I've done all sorts of types of art. I mean, I taught ceramics, I've taught jewelry, I've worked in printmaking and painting and all sorts of stuff. I was a fibers undergrad major, but there's just something about creating artist books. sometimes once it's actually finished, it's like I put together a puzzle and now I'm holding the final product and I get to constantly kind of go through it and engage with it. So there's just something different about it. It's not just on a wall. It's not just sitting there so that I can stare at it. It's something that begs me to touch it. Especially this book with the beach finds. Like, I've been working with this for 6 months now, and I still like to go through it. So there's definitely something that I personally enjoy about the process.
It feels like it might sort of have the quality of old letters or old journals looking at those things again.
Definitely, yeah.
Do you have any advice for people who want to start seeking out art books and, you know, spending a little more time with them?
I think that the most important thing about artist books is that they're for everybody. And what's great about them is that, you know, you said that there's a small amount of people that actually get to touch them and engage with them. But at least at our special collections, outside of the pandemic, people can just walk in and ask to see artist books. I know that a lot of special collections in libraries, like public libraries, people can just walk in and engage with them. So I encourage people to seek out artist books to be able to actually touch and engage with a work of art, which is not something you always get to do when you're in a gallery.
Well, Geo Rutherford, thank you so much for talking with us, and we're looking forward to seeing further incarnations of your work.
Thank you so much.
Geo Rutherford is a former Ann Arbor resident and Eastern Michigan grad who's now living in Wisconsin. How is it August already? You certainly don't have to remind any teachers about the passing of this summer. We've been talking through school issues for the fall with a variety of educators and administrators over the past couple of weeks. And today we wanted to bring Michigan's new Teacher of the Year into the conversation. Named just late last month, Owen Bondano is a ninth grade language arts teacher at Oak Park Freshman Institute. It's a public school in Oak Park. Owen Bondano, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, nice to be here.
Your school is a ninth grade inclusive campus. It's just those high school freshmen. Can you tell us a little bit about who's in the student body?
Sure. So our ninth grade academy houses between 300 and 350 students, depending on the year. Our student population is 98% African American, and many of our students come from across county lines because of school of choice. So we have a population that looks not like what you might expect when you think Oak Park, Michigan, but they're really a fantastic group. I love ninth grade. I love the exploratory nature they have and the energy and excitement of being new to high school. I love ninth graders.
Have you been able to stay in touch with very many of them?
Oh, yeah. So in the spring, I was teaching them virtually. And because of that, they have my Google Voice number. They have my email address. I text with them through Google Voice regularly. I had plenty of them sending me congratulation emails when the announcement was made a few weeks ago. We're still in touch very much.
What has your school decided about this fall?
As of this moment, we have not fully decided yet. We have a board meeting this evening to decide where they're going to vote on the superintendent's proposal. The superintendent has proposed that we start virtual for the first quarter of the school year and reevaluate in October.
How are you feeling about that?
I think that's a great decision. I think that the superintendent is looking at a lot of data, and it's one of those impossible situations where there's no one answer that can make everyone happy and meet everyone's needs. So I'm glad that she's going with a proposal that will put the least amount of people in danger.
Yeah. Oh, and those frantic weeks at the end of last school year when everybody was just rushing to figure something out online.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the so-called emergency online period was like for you?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm already fairly tech savvy as a teacher. So my students were already in Google Classroom. We were already using online single sign-in portals. We already had a lot of the tools in place that some people were scrambling to put in place at that moment. So I was lucky in that way. And that's because I think that the internet has a lot of potential for teaching our students. And I think that as a tool, it's really useful. So I try to use every useful tool I can find. So in some ways, it was easier for me than maybe for some other teachers who didn't have the tech tools in place already. But it was definitely strange to not see their faces every day. And I had to, on the fly, reinvent my curriculum to be something that not only could it be delivered from a distance, but it had to be delivered asynchronously. There was no me standing in front of the class and giving them 10 minutes of information. you know, in class, if a student has a question, I can answer it right away. And it also answers it out loud for the other 10 kids who are all thinking the same question in their heads. But in this asynchronous virtual setting, suddenly I had to field 12 emails or texts with the same question. And that takes a lot longer.
Right. So what's on your mind as you think through what you will have to do? Let's assume for the moment that the superintendent's proposal is going to pass tonight. What's on your mind for online learning in September?
Well, our online learning in the fall is going to look a little bit different. It was all asynchronous, meaning nobody had to be anywhere at the same time in the spring because we had a lot of equity issues that we were dealing with. With the fall, we have some of those equity issues a little more under control. We've gotten devices. Our district sent out over 3,000 laptops and hundreds of hotspots to our students.
Wow.
So with those tools in place, we're going to bring back in some of those more synchronous or all at the same time experiences. We're not going to replicate the school day. We're not going to expect kids to be on Zoom for 8 hours, but we are going to bring in some of those all together opportunities, which I think is going to be really important because at least in my class, things like class discussion are a big part of how we learn together.
How do those moments work in an online format?
Well, luckily I've been teaching summer school, so I've had a little bit of a preview. And we studied a book over summer school, so we had a lot of class discussions about the book. And for me, one of the nice things is that with Zoom, with the chat feature, I'm getting participation sometimes from students who might be too nervous to speak up in class because they're putting it in the chat instead. And so I've gotten pretty good at doing this whole facilitation thing where I'll see something pop into the chat and I'll be able to say, oh, I see that Kendra has said, and then I can read their comment out loud to add it into the discussion without them feeling too overwhelmed by trying to share this new format.
I mean, it's been a lot for adults to sort of adapt their meeting style to Zoom. I can only imagine what it's like for a bunch of high school freshmen.
Absolutely. And I'm not one of the teachers who's going to tell them that their camera has to be on and their mic has to be on because I don't know their home situation. I don't know if there's a reason they're not comfortable doing that. So I've been trying to utilize the chat. I've been trying to utilize online tech tools that have, you know, instantaneous engagement and stuff like that to get them engaged in ways that don't require them to maybe turn on the mic when their sister's in the next room blaring the TV. You know what I mean?
For sure. Your sister is also a teacher, and you've said and written about some advice that she gave you. She's your older sister and went through all this a little bit before you did. Could you tell us what it was the conversation that you two had?
The conversation I think you're talking about is when I was in college. I originally was going to college for music. And when I realized that teaching fit me better, I was having a lot of debate with myself about what subject I wanted to become qualified to teach. And my sister, who, as you said, is an amazing teacher, and she's 8 years older than me, she asked me to think about if I could open up every kid's head and put in one skill, what would that skill be? Her logic being that then pick the subject area that fits that skill the best. And my answer to that question was, I couldn't think of just one, so I settled for two. And it was empathy and critical thinking. And when I thought about that and my love of writing and reading, English seemed like a natural fit.
There you go. Well, would you say that your answer to that question has changed over the years? The one critical skill that you would want to put in kids' heads if you could?
I think, if anything, my dedication to empathy and critical thinking has gotten stronger. A lot of the issues that occur happen because people can't think critically, or because they won't, or because they don't have empathy for others.
Yeah. Our guest today is Owen Bondano, ninth grade language arts teacher at Oak Park Freshman Institute. Owen is Michigan's newly named Teacher of the Year. Owen, another thing I wanted to ask you about is you're known for incorporating a lot of conversations about race and anti-racism into your classroom work. When did you start doing that?
I started deliberately incorporating it maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Before that, I mean, I've always had these conversations. I've never taught in a classroom that wasn't majority Black students. And so these conversations come up naturally anyway, especially when I'm cultivating a classroom where people feel safe and they feel like they want to share and be a part of that community. But deliberately, a few years ago, I started to bring it up because I feel like my students lack tools to deal with what's happening in the world. They know what happens. They know they've experienced racism. But if you were to ask them what happened, they couldn't necessarily use a term like microaggression or privilege or oppression or something like that. And without the words to describe your experience, it becomes very difficult to talk about them with other people. So one of the things I try to do as an English teacher is I try to give them the terms to describe their experiences.
So what does that mean in terms of curriculum?
Well, one of the things I've been trying recently, I added a new book to my curriculum, which is Tiffany Jewell's This Book is Anti-Racist, which is an excellent primer aimed specifically at 10 to 15 year olds. It talks about what privileges we have and where we have power and where we don't. Also, it talks very generally about the history of racism in our society. And then the second half of the book is all about actions you can take when you encounter racism in your world. And so we study this book as a class, and I have students saying to me all the time, oh, that's happened to me. I didn't realize that that was something that happened to everyone, or I didn't realize that there was a term for that. And so just by having these conversations about who we are and what we've experienced, we sort of, as a class, develop a vocabulary together to talk about things and to make plans for what we can do next time.
Are there ways that you've had to adapt those issues and conversations to an online environment? I mean, I feel like when you can talk with someone in person, you can engage them in a conversation about race that feels very intimate and very personal, and maybe hopefully also safe, you know, that they would feel comfortable sharing things they might not also share. Is it more difficult when you're interacting with students online?
Well, in a physical classroom, I work very hard to make my students feel safe. We spend a lot of time, especially at the beginning of the year, but even throughout the year, talking together, having conversations, doing activities that bring us together so that when we have these deeper conversations, we have a level of trust already built. And it's certainly harder to do a lot of those things in an online setting, but it just means that I have to double down on these things that make us feel safe together and having these conversations about when the topics are still relatively safe so that when we get deeper, we feel safe with each other. But also, a lot of the online engagement tools that I'm using allow students to participate in ways that are less frightening than saying it in front of a whole group of people in person. The ability, for example, to private chat someone on Zoom. I promise my students that if they send me something privately in Zoom, I won't identify them when I add it to the conversation. I can just say, oh, I see someone has said in the chat, and then read it and add it without them having to fear that their name is going to be attached to that statement.
Sure. Hey, Owen, when you became Michigan's Teacher of the Year this year, it was a bit of a moment for trans people all over Michigan. You're the first Teacher of the Year that we know of who is trans. Could you tell us about when you decided to come out in the workplace?
That was a journey for me, for sure. I transitioned in college, so before I was in a professional setting. And very quickly, I came out to the coworkers that I trusted. It's hard to, in my opinion and in my experience, it's hard to build meaningful relationships with people without at some point mentioning that fundamental fact about myself. Mm-hmm. But I was not out to students, mostly because up until this past June with the Supreme Court decision, I could have been fired for the wrong parent complaining. It would have been legal to fire me because of my gender identity.
Right.
And so I kept it from students for that reason. I also feared a little bit that I feared that revealing something about myself that could inspire so many divided opinions might make it harder for me to build community with certain students. And since building community is my job, it felt like I'd be doing my job less effectively. But over time, the weight of not coming out got heavier and heavier, especially because when I got into teaching, I told myself that I would be the teacher that I needed when I was in high school. And by not being out, I wasn't fulfilling that promise. So this past school year was the first time that I was out to my students as well. And that was after a lot of conversation with my admin and my union and everybody else to make sure that I would be protected. So this year was the first time that I was out to students. And I didn't ever declare it to students or anything. It just comes out in conversation, especially when we spend so much time at the start of the year talking about our identities and who we are and what communities we're a part of. I do all of that work with my students to be transparent and to build their trust with me as well. So they saw it in those conversations. And instead of making the community more fractured, like I had feared, it actually made us a much stronger community, I think. And I've had many students just this past year who have told me that the fact that I can say these things about myself without shame or fear is inspiring to them. Whether or not they're also LGBTQ, they find it, I might be the first person they've ever seen who stands up and just says, like, it's a normal thing that you should not be ashamed of, that I'm transgender. And that's meaningful to them.
Yeah. High school is a time of a lot of discovery when there are many firsts like that, you know, meeting people, you know, maybe that you didn't realize were of a different faith, or sort of figuring out your own stance on gender or gender issues. Have you ever had students who were maybe students who needed more conversation because they hadn't been expecting that? And they maybe, you know, maybe this is not even a term or a thing that they were aware of.
One of the great things about being a teacher is encountering the curiosity that's natural to children. And so when I say I'm transgender in front of this group of 15-year-old children, the curiosity is natural. And I get many, many questions right away. And I know now from experience that the moment that word comes out of my mouth, I can throw away the rest of the hour's lesson plan because we're going to be answering questions for the rest of the hour now. And so what I've found is that I have not, at this point, I have not encountered hostility from a student. I have encountered students who are more curious than others, and that curiosity has with it a tinge of judgment or whatever baggage they're bringing from their family or their home or their own belief system. And so all I try to do is be open with them. You know, I keep the conversation obviously student friendly and appropriate, but I try to be open with them and honest with them. And I want them to just see that I am a person and that I am their teacher and that I care for them. And I found that often the fact that I continue to be a caring, supportive teacher to them eventually melts away any resistance they may have had, because they're shown again and again and again that there's nothing wrong with me and that I'm a person they can trust and love.
Oh, and is that difficult for you, having to be the living laboratory for, you know, certain new experiences that these kids are having of gender identity every fall?
I wouldn't call it difficult. I would call it an honor. You know, I signed up for this gig knowing that there might come time where my identity made my job more difficult or made it different from the way that other teachers experience their jobs. And I also signed up for this gig because I love helping kids grow. I love helping further them on their personal journeys. So in some ways, I feel like it's an honor to help shape where they're headed. And in some ways, I feel like I'm doing valuable work for all the other LGBTQ people around me, that I'm making the world safer for them by having these conversations now when these students are 14 and 15. And I just feel honored to be in a place to be able to do that.
I can only imagine what it's meant to some of the queer or gender non-binary kids in your school.
Yeah, I have a lot of really great moments of students who are tentative at first with me, and it's because they've got something inside of them that they're wrestling with. And to see them sit and become more solid in their comfort in my room is amazing.
Owen Bondano is Michigan's new Teacher of the Year. He teaches ninth grade language arts at Oak Park Freshman Institute in Oak Park. Owen, we wish you all the luck this fall and a very safe restart to school. We'll be thinking about you. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. This was wonderful.
All right. It is the Jamie and Stoney show on this day that we'll have the home opener at Comerica Park.
I kind of like seeing the ballpark empty. You see all these like
a longtime Detroit broadcasting voice went silent over the weekend. Sports broadcaster Jamie Samuelson died of colon cancer. He had just announced to listeners last week on WXYT The Ticket that he even had cancer. Jamie was known on air for his cool head and his good sense of humor about sports, along with just about everything else. But he used his last moments on air to advocate for folks to go get colonoscopies. We're going to let him do the same here on this show.
Because a colonoscopy, and you hear about it all the time, and you're like, blah, 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 1 year out the next, it can literally save your life. It literally can. I've never been a big soapbox guy. My soapbox today and for the number of years that I'm going to continue to fight this is going to be, get a colonoscopy, please.
Jamie Samuelson was 48 years old and is survived by three kids and a wife, also a longtime broadcaster, Christy McDonald. The whole team at Stateside sends our love. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.